Good evening.
Good evening.
Should do introductions around. We have a new face tonight. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm Helen.
Judy.
Jeffrey.
Samia.
Wendy.
I'm Eric.
Eric.
Marie.
And Angie. Did you find us on the internet?
Yes. Yeah, I moved into the area about 4 or 5 months ago.
I see.
I've been meaning to come someplace early, but hadn't until tonight. Yeah.
Takes in a lot of adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you.
I have an announcement, and that is that Brigitte, because she is working so much with all the different religious teachers in the area of San Jose, and even went to Salt Lake City to the World Conference this year, and is very much keyed into sort of ecumenical, overall broad view of things, has made friends with the imam, an imam in San Jose, and has invited him to come and speak on the 6th of January, which is a Wednesday night. And that's their time, but we're invited, and several other little sanghas are also invited to come and meet with him. So I accepted for all of us. I'm afraid I just jumped at the suggestion because I thought it was so fine. Also, this is the last night of Rohatsa Sesshin. We sit from the 1st to the 8th of December. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have been sitting for this last week in celebration of everybody's enlightenment. It was Buddha's, it's what we say in Japanese Zen, it's Buddha's Enlightenment Day. Although, like all of these days, it's all arbitrarily made up, and I think it fits into the dark time of year that another way of celebrating light is really important. So we'll have a one-day sit on Saturday to celebrate the same thing. San Diego had theirs last Sunday, and I gave a talk on Skype with their group, so it's expanded in a lot of different directions. Chikoji is still sitting. They'll be finished on Friday, I think. So if you want to slip into a session, there's one going on up there. Lots of practice. Lots of practice. So we are, as far as I can tell, on Chapter 5 of Refining Your Life. I don't know if you know this book, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
It's Dogen's essay on cooking and the cook. And, of course, it's very expanded from there. And also very, very practical at the same time. And Uchiyama Roshi was a contemporary of my teacher in Japan, and taught at Antaiji, which was a little zendo outside of Kyoto. And Uchiyama Roshi wrote a commentary on Dogen's discussion of the job of the cook. So we've read the Dogen part, and now we're reading the Uchiyama Roshi part. So they're very short, very simple chapters, but cogent. So this is nice. This is seeing the world without holding worldly values. It's a good time of year to think about this. It's a deluge, isn't it? It's an absolute deluge. He first talks about how we are all trying so hard to be happy. And that we are always measuring our life by how happy or unhappy we are. And what a miserable life that makes. Because we're always trying to figure it out. Oh, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? I like it, I don't like it. And in the process, we're actually missing the experience of whatever it is that's going on. We can't experience them both at the same time. It says, happiness, the idea of seeking happiness presupposes that at present we are unhappy. So I just got a little note from a friend who has been through a lot of trouble, physical trouble, and ended saying all he has left is hope. And I thought, actually in Zen we don't even do hope, much less trying to urge ourselves toward happiness, because that too is extra. It's an extra thought on top of what's actually going on. So we're not free to act within the present moment if we burden ourselves with an idea about what it is. He says, in Buddhism, this kind of dualistic thinking has no place. Said, just living out your life, regardless of the circumstances, is the absolute reality of your life. Or as they say, just do it. Whatever's right in front of us, we do. But then we look back, or we look ahead, and try to make a story about it. Usually people think only in terms of how they can better their situation, if only a little bit, and avoid suffering. Seeing things from the perspective of the Buddha Dharma or of big mind means to cease engaging in this type of prejudiced, discriminated thinking, and to be resolved that whatever we meet is our life. This is it. This is the it of it. He says, I don't mean one should become inert. We cannot live day by day without discriminating. There's no human life in which there is no difference drawn between miso, we all know what miso is, and kuso, which is shit. He said, this is why the question arises in the Tenzo Kyokun about whether one separates the sand from the rice or the rice from the sand. Because in China, in the old days, when they harvested rice, it ended up with a lot of pebbles in it. And one of the jobs of the cook was to make sure to get all the little rocks out of it before he cooked it up. He said, in our daily lives, we have to discriminate, but what we must not forget is the fundamental attitude grounding this discrimination. Everything we encounter is our life. This is the attitude of big mind. We can't throw it away. we can do this, and we do this, we narrow our life down. It's interesting because I was just thinking about what life is like in prison, especially in solitary, because there's so many people in solitary these days. And yet there are people living for years in solitary who have huge mind, do deep, deep studies, and stay awake. So big mind isn't about where we are. Big mind is how we are able to accept where we are and be that. He says, I want to stress again that living out your life firmly grounded in big mind does not mean you become dumb and mute, nor that life is devoid of the scenery of enlightenment and illusion, heaven and hell, success and failure, or happiness and unhappiness. Nevertheless, living with the attitude that everything that arises in your life is the element of stability that Dogen Zenji taught as Shikhan Daza. So once we connect in sitting practice with the stability of our own life and breath, we have that as a refuge wherever we are. We are that. It's not just a matter of sitting on a cushion. It's developing a mind that is able to be equanimous wherever it is and just be like this. This is the attitude of a person practicing Zazen and at the same time the posture of a person of Zen. A posture in the broadest sense of the word. So we carry ourselves with dignity through the world in a very simple and modest way because we have it already. We've discovered this place in us on which we always depend. It's always been there, here. The reason we find hell or unhappiness unbearable and run around longing to escape is because we cling so strongly to the desire for happiness. He says, in the East, this is seen as a demon making a plaything out of you in the same way a cat does a mouse. We all run about confused, and the demon taunts us all the more for our own confusion. However, since everything, even misfortune, is our life, the essential capacity in these circumstances is to meet adversity with an attitude of equanimity. If we fall into hell, then we need to resolve to see that hell as our home. When we are being boiled in the demon's cauldron, that's where we have to do Zazen. If we're pursued up a mountain of needles, we should be willing to climb that mountain hand over hand, even at the risk of our life. When we throw all our life energy into whatever we might encounter, no demon can help but retreat. What a way to live, he says. And of course, this was Buddha's experience under the tree. That instead of trying to transcend his life and trying to discover some kind of ultimate happiness and truth and satisfaction, he finally gave up. He tried for 6 years. And when he sat down, he had to face his demons, you could say. The things he thought he could avoid, that he thought he could discover a way to touch heaven. And of course, in the end, he said, all beings and the whole earth itself are enlightened with me. He saw it's already right here. Uchiyama says, we view heaven or hell, enlightenment or delusion, all with the same eye. When we have developed this kind of attitude toward our lives, the meaning of living day by day changes completely, along with our valuation of the events and people and circumstances that arise. Since we no longer try to escape from delusion, misfortune, or adversity, nor chase after enlightenment and peace of mind, things like money and position lose their former value. People's reputations or their skills at maneuvering a society have no bearing on the way we see them as human beings, nor does a certificate of enlightenment make any impression on anyone. In other words, once we can accept ourselves and our life, we can accept other people without putting people up there and being afraid of them or awed by them or putting them down there and feeling contempt for people we imagine we're better than. There really is no comparison. Says the Tenzo Kyokan shows us in a concrete way just how to cultivate this attitude through careful handling of the food we use to prepare meals. We need to face everything that arises with the entire meaning and value of each encounter, seeing everything as our life, this life, me. So he says the Tenzo Kyokan is a remarkably compassionate text. It shows us how to discover a deeply refined religious life through our daily activities. Your attitude toward things should not be contingent upon their quality. He says, in the end, all things have one taste. So maybe that's enough to talk about the Tenzo never complains. In a monastery, whatever food is donated, it's what they eat. And so it doesn't help to complain about it. It's, in fact, helps a lot to be grateful for it. And that's the other side of this subject, that it's not just that we are equanimous in the middle of our life and accept it, but we can be very grateful for what comes to us, for every bit of food, for every advantage and disadvantage, the things that knock us down and teach us lessons and grow us up and show us what the way is. Suffering isn't getting bumped around or hitting boulders. Suffering is holding on so tightly to our idea about how things should be happening to me that everything hurts. Everything becomes an impediment to this me that wants everything to be okay. And things are never okay like that. There's a huge amount of not okayness in the world right now. Huge, huge, huge amount. And it's so important to be able to see with big mind and embrace and hold all of it. There's always tremendous pain and difficulty and violence going on in the world, but now we're extremely aware of it, and we're in the way of it as well. And so it's our opportunity to not narrow our view and turn away, but to embrace it as it is. Because only if we can embrace it, know it as it is, can we act in an intelligent and truthful way. We get so much information now, so much, way too much information. And it leads the mind to believe that I've got to do something about this. It requires very, very careful thought to see very discriminatingly what we can do and what we can't. And then do what we can do. We can't change the big things in the big way. We're our world, and our world is right here, right now. But we can change our world every moment. And the more we're able to accept it, the more we're able to find a way through it that's of benefit to the world and to ourselves as well. But it takes guts, because it's not so person-affirming, me-affirming. You know, we like sort of noble and heroic ways of being and feeling like we could do something really big and important, but actually the most important things we can do are the small things. The very, very moment-by-moment things that our nourishment and encouragement and keep the world rolling along. We don't know where it's going. I'm so old now, I've seen it go through this kind of stuff a lot of times. It's kind of Shakyamuni Buddha went through it too. His people were decimated by his cousins, and they had little tribal groups, and his father's tribal group was overwhelmed by his father's cousins' group. And they took over their land and killed everybody. That was 2,000 years ago. And Buddha tried to stop them. And the first time he shamed them, and the second time they did it anyway. So it's not like this is new. This is human being. I always say it's human being in kindergarten, that we just haven't matured enough yet to figure out how to do this thing without tearing each other limb from limb. because it's really hard. But I think sitting practice itself is the clue. And over all these millennia, way before Buddha, people have been sitting and finding this place and bringing it back over and over again. It's the best thing we can do. So, are there questions?
The part where you say finding a place and then bringing it back over and over again, I think that's one of the things about this practice that I think I was drawn to, but also that makes it frustrating, because you're used to when you start something to become better at it and to succeed at it. And so sometimes, you know, like, not the thing is how to sit, but have no I have no expectations of it, and sometimes you have to, at least for me, you have to remind yourself of that. Sometimes people feel like you feel like you're not reaching a goal.
Exactly. Yeah, we're not getting better at it. There's some, sometimes people come to me and say, "I just had such a terrible sit," or "I can't sit." And terrible sit is a good sit. I mean, we don't know. We just offer ourselves and surrender to it and let it be whatever it is. That's hard to do. We want to orchestrate it somehow and make it do what we want it to do, but we can't. It's a great point. Yeah, thank you. Wendy?
So Uchiyama said, don't look at the quality of different things. Everything tastes the same. I know also in the cook instructions it says, five basic flavors. I mean, don't we have that in life, too?
We do. We try to make things as tasty as we can. but we don't cling to any of it. That the problem comes when we try to think of some kind of very, very fancy food, like a beautiful big fish that's on a platter with all the things around it and something really gorgeous and yummy. That really, once it goes in the stomach, it's no better than a piece of bread and cheese. It's like that we can truly appreciate the big platter of fish, and it's wonderful. But if we're going to try to figure out which has the higher value, Dogen is saying there's no higher value. In the end, it's all the same. It all goes in the same mouth and is used in the same way.
Yeah, but the process is different. I mean, either you enjoy it or maybe it gives you indigestion.
Sure. And then you appreciate it. Oh, thank you very much. And numerous labors brought us this food. We appreciate it a whole lot.
Right.
And if it's gruel, we appreciate that. And if it's a beautiful fish, we appreciate that.
So it's about not having preferences.
Yes. Because often we don't have an opportunity even to have preferences. In some situations, we just are darn lucky to be receiving anything at all. And in fact, that's really the truth. And every single time we sit down to eat, it's a blessing. We just forget.
Samadhi that goes, the great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose? Or is that...
That's the third patriarch.
The trust in mind.
Trust in mind, yes.
Yeah,
but that's what, that's the very first sentence.
That's what we're talking about.
No picking and choosing. Yeah. Yeah, just appreciate what you get. But that doesn't mean that when you go to the grocery store that you don't choose one thing over another. Of course, we do. And are glad that we have a choice, or sometimes overwhelmed that there are so many choices. I mean, we live in a very weird world, really, where we have this plethora of choices and everything. There was once a movie about a Russian who sneaked off of a ship and came into New York and was taken around. And he went into a grocery store and looking for coffee, and he went a little crazy because he'd never seen so much coffee in his life. It's like that. We just don't even realize how much we have. I felt that when I went to India and came back and walked into Safeway. It's just too much. Well, it's 8:00. I wanted to remind you, some of you haven't seen this calendar, but I told Terry I would talk about it to everybody as much as I could. She put it together. Tom Mayer was one of Kogan's students, my teacher's student, and painted many paintings. There are 12 of them in this calendar. And she made this calendar for it as a benefit for something in Taos. Mary is in Taos. She sat with us a few times. I probably don't remember her. But this is available for $20, and here's the information if you're interested. Are there announcements?
Well, you covered that. I could add that some Sangha members we haven't seen for a while will be here Saturday sitting with us. Isao and Bob, Laura from San Diego, Carolyn's going to be here in the afternoon.
Yoshiko is probably coming from Sacramento.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So, Ms. Eno, do you have a...
So, I'm opening on Saturday, and then Wendy and Ellie are organizing...
And Judy
organizing the rotation. Yeah. And then next week, Jennifer's opening, Judy's Domon, and Ellie's Makukyo. So, the new rotation is that whenever you're Domon, the next week you're Makukyo.
In general.
unless people are not there.
Well, you know, I noticed the variation. But anyway, so yeah, so Jennifer is able to open.
I'll check with her, and if not.
She's planning on it. She told me she is.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I haven't seen her for a while.
She opened
and left.
Not
right.
Last week, yeah, the week before.
She opened.
Well, I have an announcement. I brought some books, and they're in the vestibule, and you're welcome to take as many as, or as few as you would like. There's one bag that's mostly Tibetan Buddhism, and I know not everyone is going to be interested, but take a look and see if you can find something to take home.
Thank you.
You're always so supportive of my efforts. Trim down my life.
Someday I'm going to bring my truckload. But we're not ready for that.
Okay.
Well, let's have our 1 minute sit.